Professor Gaffney.
Thank you. And as you know, I will be here for all of February. And I apparently am scheduled for some 35 or more presentations, so I know if this is Wednesday, I am in Long Beach. Right? Other than that, I have no idea who's sitting here before me. Let me explain the premise of this presentation. It really is somewhat personal in that it relates to the field, the particular field that I teach at the Hebrew University. My area of expertise is Jewish history in the post-biblical period and until the end of late antiquity, roughly from around 500 BCE to 500 CE. What we call in Israel the Second Temple period, different people, depending on your religious or other orientation, you might call it, some people would call it the intertestamental period or late antiquity. Everybody has another definition. But for Israelis, and even before them, for the founders of the Zionist movement, this period plays a very special role. It had a very unique position in the Zionist and subsequent Israeli ethos. The reason being that this was deemed by the first, I would say, almost the founders of the Zionist movement in the late 19th and early 20th century as being the last stage of Jewish normalcy. That is to say, when Jews, A, still lived in a land that was identified with them, in fact, it was even called Judea by the Romans. At certain times, they were actually independent. They had a monarchy. They had an army. Everything that was considered to be proper, right, for a state and for a nation, certainly considered in the 19th century to be proper for a state. A reality that was corrupted as we embark on the Middle Ages, certainly after the destruction of the Temple and of Jerusalem in the year 70, and after the Bar Kokhba, the last attempt at removing the Roman yoke from Judea in the years 132 to 135. And so this period assumed a role almost, or if you wish, became a role model of sorts, or at least a basis for drawing models, for drawing heroes. And much was made, even later on in Israel, of the similarity between the two periods. Now, what do I mean? Not only was this the last stage of Jewish independence, it was the last example, for instance, of Jews striking coins until the modern state of Israel. As I said, it was the last example of a Jewish army. It was I'll give you one example of a similarity between the two periods, between the modern reality in which we live today and that period, and they are unique in the annals of Jewish history. These are the only two stages when we encounter simultaneously a major Jewish center in the land of Israel, at times even independent or autonomous, independent, and simultaneously a large, thriving Jewish diaspora. An identified one, an assertive one, a proud one, an active one, an involved diaspora. Involved, among other things, not only in their own life, but in the life of their brethren in the land of Israel. Now, this duality does not exist in the biblical period. We don't know of a diaspora in the biblical period. In fact, in the biblical period, the very notion of dispersion is a threat. If you misbehave, you will be dispersed. And I'm sure that many of you, anyone who's ever or is or has been a parent or a teacher knows that threats are potent and meaningful only when they are not reality, right? A threat has to be something so frightening that one cannot imagine what would happen, right, if this were actually to come and turn into reality. But for, of course, the prophets and even for the Torah, the books of Moses, if you misbehave, you will be dispersed. And, of course, I like to say, I wonder if a prophet were to show up today in modern Israel and stand in the middle of one of the thoroughfares of Jerusalem and proclaim, those who misbehave will be given tickets to go abroad, right, you would have lines, around the city, right? And so one person's threat is another person's dream or promise. But if you think about it, when we come to Second Temple, we have this duality of Jewish existence. When you get to the Middle Ages, the pendulum swings to the other extreme. Now, I'm not saying there were not Jews in the land during the Middle Ages, but numerically, the vast, vast majority were living outside of the land. But not only numerically, I would say in terms of where the action was, where the intellectual action was, where the creation of an ongoing culture, much of the activity was taking place outside of the land, at least until we get to the latter part of the Middle Ages and creeping into modernity, when things begin to take place in 17th or 16th, 17th century Safed, and then later on in Jerusalem. But primarily, the Middle Ages are a diaspora-oriented reality. It's when you get to modernity that you find this duality again. So Israelis were aware of the fact, and this similarity is interesting. I might tell you, just so you have a sense of who I am, I spend most of my waking and not so much waking hours in the first century, not in the 20th or 21st century. I highly prefer the first century for all sorts of reasons. I enjoy walking the streets of Alexandria in the first century, stopping Jews on the street and asking them for their sense of self-identity. Don't ask me how I recognize a Jew in the first century in Alexandria. He certainly did not have distinctive clothing or any other. In fact, he did not yet have a Jewish nose even. We profilers know how to identify. And I will stop a man on the street and say, will you please, in three or four sentences, give me a sense of your Jewish identity, and the answer that I might get from this first person will be, well, I'll tell you, yes, I live in Alexandria, and my livelihood is here, but my heart and soul and thoughts are constantly in Jerusalem. I send my shekel on a yearly basis to the Temple of Jerusalem. I've been on pilgrimage twice to Jerusalem. Our synagogues are oriented towards Jerusalem. And in fact, we're even involved in the political situation of Israel. Just the other year, Herod's grandson, Agrippa the First, visited us, and we went out into the streets and received him like our own monarch. It caused a little pogrom, but nevertheless, we saw him as one of our own. I must tell you, I'm waiting for him to say that he's waiting for his daughter to finish high school, and then he will actually come and move. But I'll then walk down the street and encounter my second interview, as it were, and I'll ask the second person, now, can you please define your self-image of being a Jew? And the answer I get is enlightening. This person tells me, I am the proud citizen of the illustrious polis, or Greek city of Alexandria. I've lived here all my life, as have my father and grandfather and forefathers, going back to the foundation of the city by Alexander the Great, which, by the way, was a myth. Most of the Jews came as captives after the death of Alexander the Great, but they believed that they got in on the ground floor. And I'm proud to be here. My religious proclivities are somewhat different than most of the other citizens of Alexandria, right? But that's really none of your business. It's almost as if he were saying, I am an Alexandrian of Mosaic persuasion. And I hope that that conjures up in some of your minds, right, an answer that we might have encountered if we were to ask the same question, not in first century Alexandria, but in 19th century Berlin, asking some Jews, that you would have gotten a very similar answer. And it's not by chance that certain groups of, I use German Jewry as an example because they're probably the best example, actually looked back to Alexandria and to people like Philo, the noted Jewish philosopher of first century Alexandria, as being the ideal image of a Jew living in a non-Jewish environment and nevertheless maintaining his Jewish identity, but nevertheless being also totally immersed in the surrounding culture. And they consider that to be the ideal, almost to be emulated. So there are these comparisons. And as a result, the state of Israel drew on this similarity in choosing its ideal, its models of heroes, and they were the Maccabees, or they were the zealots of the war against the Romans, and I'm going to allude to that in a few minutes. The mountaintop of Masada, right, was again pointed at for whatever reasons as being the epitome of heroism. I can tell you that as an Israeli, when I was sworn in to the Israeli army, they brought us there at 4 o'clock in the morning. We were all asleep at the time. We were standing, right, and we were given rifles and Bibles, and none of us really knew what we were doing there. But and it wasn't quite clear: are we being told to commit suicide or what? Because, but it was so early in the morning that we figured it was our lack of knowledge rather than anything else. But these were the heroes. Bar Kokhba was a hero. There is not a city in Israel that does not have a street either named after Bar Kokhba or Elazar ben Yair, the commander of the Jewish zealots at Masada, or a street named Beitar, the last outpost of Bar Kokhba, and so on and so forth. These were the Israeli heroes. In fact, Israeli coins and Israeli stamps used the symbols and the images on the coins that were struck by Bar Kokhba in creating its own either coinage or stamps and what have you. If you look at the names of Israeli sports clubs or youth movements, again, this resonates, right? You have Maccabi as a sports club, which always struck us as being very, very ironic, and you realize why. Because the Maccabees, of course, were fighting against the Hellenistic phenomena that was taking over the Middle East. And we know that one of the mainstays of Hellenistic thought was, of course, athleticism, right? And so here we are calling our athletic clubs Maccabi, right? And to make things worse, there's sort of a marathon race every year carrying flames or flares or torches to the graves of the Maccabees near a place called Modiin. It's as if to make old man Mattathias roll over in his grave. Nevertheless, the only consolation that I can impart to you is that they're not buried there and so they don't see it. These are graves that somebody, for some reason, identified as the graves of the Maccabees, and it has nothing to do with Maccabees. But this is the point. So there's Maccabi, there's another youth movement and sports club known as Beitar, again, named after Bar Kokhba's stronghold. Even the religious, in looking for a name for a youth movement, very, very carefully chose the name of one of the rabbis, Akiva, and for good reason. So we have B'nai Akiva. Why? Because Akiva embodied for the modern religious Zionist, right, the synthesis of the two elements that would be the basis for the new state. On the one hand, spirituality. Here is the great rabbi Akiva. But on the other hand, Akiva was also a supporter of the political activism of Bar Kokhba. He is quoted as saying that Bar Kokhba is the Messiah, or at least a potential Messiah. So you have this synthesis here. And I always found it very interesting that there are no youth movements in Israel called B'nai Rashi or something like that, Sons of Rashi or Rabbeinu Gershon Me'or HaGolah or some other medieval sage. It just did not resonate at all. And you realize that for Israelis, the Middle Ages were perceived as being a very uncomfortable period, a period in which Jews did not have control of their fate, right? We kind of created a bridge between modernity and the Second Temple period, and hopefully a bridge not just spanning the two periods, but getting us over that difficult period. Think for a moment the Israeli national anthem, Hatikva, the hope. But it is Hatikva Shenot Alpaim, the hope of 2,000 years. When you say that, you're making a statement. And what is the statement? That 2,000 years ago, there was something proper, something more or less normal, right? It was corrupted. In its stead, there came a hope, and that hope has achieved a certain degree of fruition in right with the founding of the State of Israel. So you're also consciously, not just subconsciously, you are consciously drawing that connection between what existed 2,000 years ago and what exists today. Now, all this is legitimate, except that it leads to a second stage. And this is really what I'm getting at. Because there are similarities between the two periods, people tend to draw analogies. They tend to take these comparisons and run further with them. An analogy can go in two directions. It's a two-way street. It can go from the present to the past. It can go from the past to the present. What do I mean? Psychologically, we all imagine the past using frames of reference that we are familiar with in the present. This is something we cannot overcome. Everyone does it. You imagine what you do not know using various contexts with which you are familiar. Artists did this in the Middle Ages. If you look at the most famous paintings of the Middle Ages, they were always the paintings either of the Nativity or of the Crucifixion. And look at the Roman soldiers standing around and how they're dressed. Well, of course, if the painters were Italian Renaissance artists or pre-Renaissance artists, all of the Romans have good Italian dress on them. If the painter was a Spanish painter, suddenly all of the Romans are Spanish grandees and so on and so forth. In other words, you are projecting yourself. You are almost imposing yourself, as it were, on the past. We all do this. And this, I will show you in a minute, is what was done in trying to understand that period of antiquity, the Second Temple period. That's a conceptual, it's a hypothetical analogy. I'm going to give you an example of this, but then I'm going to get to another example of an analogy that goes in the other direction, which I would refer to more as a practical or as an operative analogy, and that's going from the past to the present. Saying, well, since these two periods are so similar, why don't we examine the mistakes of the past and then correct them in the present, right? Now, of course, you realize what the fallacy of this exercise is. You are creating a past based on notions of the present, so you are re-imaging the past based on the present. Well, then, of course, that past that you have re-imaged now will supply all the solutions for the present, right? Because it really isn't the past to begin with, right? It is a sort of a phony past that then leads into the present and solves all the problems of the present. And this is something that is done in Israel quite frequently, and I'll show you how it's done also as we proceed. But let me give you an example of the first type of analogy, from the present to the past. I have participated during my years as a teacher at the Hebrew University many, many times in the media in Israel. Usually on certain specific days of the Jewish calendar for which my particular area of expertise warranted some sort of appearance. For instance, Hanukkah, the holiday that commemorates the Maccabean victory, would be one example. Another example would be the day that commemorates the destruction of the second, or both temples, Tisha B'Av, in the summer. You have to remember that until recently, Israel did not have cable TV. In fact, until a little further back, it only had one channel. And on nights like the 9th of Av, I mean, literally, and everything else was shut down in the country, you could literally either watch this program or go to sleep watching the program, as it were. But there was absolutely nothing else to do, right? So you had the whole state as a captive audience, and people got to know me as the fellow that appears on Tisha B'Av. I've had friends telling me, you know, if they see me on TV, they know they should be sad, right? But of course, the producers and directors at the when TV Israeli TV was being spawned really had the limited imagination, and everything was talking heads because Israelis love to talk. And usually they would raise a problem. This would be the theme of the program. And then, of course, they would bring in the politicians to talk about it, because those are the only people that are really willing to talk, without needing much encouragement, right? And what they would usually do is raise a question, and then they would bring in politicians that, of course, span the political spectrum, and then they would bring in a historian to represent the truth, as it were. And they would sit you down on a table, and sure enough, this happened to me a number of years ago. And the title of the program was, Why Did the Maccabean or Hasmonean State Fall? Now, you know, the Maccabees, there are actually two stages to the Maccabean enterprise. The first stage was a rebellion against the kingdom of the Greeks, the northern kingdom of Syria, the Seleucid Empire, Antiochus IV, Epiphanes. There had been some religious persecution and so on, and so there was an uprising against that. But the second stage, which came some decades later, was the founding of a Jewish state. And that Jewish state existed in the land until the year 63 BCE, when the Romans conquered Judea and basically ultimately turned it into a province, a Roman province. And so the theme of the program was, why did the state fall? And they sat us down at a table. I was in the middle. One politician to my right, the other to my left, my far left. They asked both of them that question. They started with the person to my right. I have to be very careful here. I cannot name names for obvious reasons. But they turned to the woman to my right first. This is good Jewish tradition. Some of you may know what I'm alluding to, but according to Jewish classical tradition, you always open things up with a kohen, right? And so they turn to her first. And this, some of you may know. I know this is not fair. I'm hiding things from some of the audience. Nevertheless, they asked her, why did the state fall? And she said, well, it's clear why the state fell, because they could not remain sufficiently steadfast in the light of pressure from the West, Rome. And in other words, they could not remain united. Had they remained united, had the Jewish political and the population in general stood steadfast against pressures from the West, cultural as well as military pressures, the state would not have fallen. But there was a civil war prior to the conquest by the Romans, between the two sons of one of the kings, Alexander Junius, and that led to the fall of the state. Then they turned to the person to my left and they asked him, why do you think the state fell? And he did not have to think for a moment. He knew why. It was due to the Maccabees' territorial expansion. They not only expanded, but their expansion included rule and conquest over non-Jewish populations, and we all know that conquest corrupts. And so what happened is the state really imploded. In other words, it became an immoral, the ethical and moral basis for the state had been relinquished, and once they lost that moral underpinning, well, the state was doomed to fall. And I'm listening to these two politicians, and I know why the state fell. The state fell because the Romans were there, and they were capturing all of the Middle East at the time, and we happened to be there also, right? And they captured... Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm all for unity, and I'm all for moral righteousness, right? I don't deny either of those aspects as being very proper and nice. Whether that would have kept the Romans out is another question. One has to realize the Romans had already conquered Syria, and they were about to invade Egypt, and we really happened to be in the way, right, as it were. And they're going to pass through Judea on the way down to Egypt. But of course, to make the point a little more obvious, these two propositions are very interesting, but let's take both scenarios to their logical conclusion. We take the first side. I always imagined the Roman general who was going to conquer Judea, his name was Pompeius, right, Pompey. And there he is in Syria, and he has to decide, is he going to invade Judea to the south? And I always imagined him saying, Aristobulus II and Hyrcanus II, the two sons of Alexander, together in one camp? I can't invade them, right? They're united, right? Let's go look for some divided country to conquer, right? And he would have somehow leapfrogged over Judea and looked for some divided political entity, but he would have been frightened off by this Jewish unity. But of course, the other scenario was no less interesting. Imagine that this had remained a moral, upstanding, righteous state. Queen Alexandra Salome, who was the queen at the time, just prior, is at home reading Psalms or as good Jewish women in the 18th century, Tenaren or some other good book that ought to be read. The two boys, Aristobulus II and Hyrcanus II, are off in yeshiva studying somewhere. And of course, Pompey would have said, I can't conquer this state. These are righteous people. These are morally right, correct people. Let's go look for a corrupt state to capture. And he would have, and I'm, goodness knows there must have been corrupt states around in the area at the time, and he would have captured them, right? And of course, you realize what I'm doing here, right? These politicians were using ancient history as props on which to hang their own political agenda, right? And this, of course, is just part of the issue. The issue becomes much more, I think, problematic when we take the analogy and we take it in the other direction. And we say, let's use the past and the mistakes of the past to solve, or if not solve, at least correct the problems of the present. And this happened in my particular field almost, it's about 30, no, I'm sorry, 25 years ago, when one of my colleagues at the Hebrew University, the late professor, many of you may have read his book, even Yehoshafat Harkavi, who was the head of military intelligence, and then when he left the army, became a professor of political science at the Hebrew University, wrote a book about the last Jewish war against the Romans, the Bar Kokhba uprising, during the years 1632 to 135. And the premise of the book was that this fellow Bar Kokhba was a criminal because he embarked upon a war that was doomed to failure. That was the bottom line of the book. And to go to war without a chance of victory is not only foolish, but in light of the fact that hundreds or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of youth would be killed in this war, it is in fact a criminal act that Bar Kokhba undertook. If you read Harkavi's book, you'll find that he actually enhances his argument by claiming that in all of ancient Jewish history, when they embarked upon impossible wars, this is what happened. And he quotes three in particular: the destruction of the first temple, when they went to war against the Babylonians, what fools, why didn't they listen to Jeremiah the prophet, why did they make some sort of an alliance with the Egyptians at the time against the Babylonians, and so the first temple was destroyed. His second example is the year 70 of the Common Era, when they went to war against the Romans, the Zealots, right? Did they not realize that Rome was the military machine of the ancient world, and to go to war against them was doomed to defeat? And the third example was Bar Kokhba in 132 to 135. Now, you realize that he very elegantly skipped over one major confrontation, which is one that I've alluded to already in my lecture today, and that was the Hasmonean War. Why do you think he skipped over that war? Unfortunately, they won, right? And in other words, and we'll get to that in a second. I found it disturbing when the book came out, not for any political reasons. And it was clear that Harkavi, and he did not deny this, wrote the book for political reasons. He's not a historian of this period that he wrote about. And that, of course, is probably why I was annoyed more than anything else. You know, we don't like outsiders on our turf, as it were. But I can tell you that many of my colleagues whose political positions were, if we use these very almost vulgar terms, right and left, were even far to the left of Harkavi, nevertheless were outraged by the book, in particular my own professor at the Hebrew University, the late Professor Menachem Stern, because of a premise that was insinuated into the book, which we all felt really goes against the grain of Jewish, not just of Jewish history, but really of the Jewish ethos, and if you wish, even of the Western humanitarian ethos. This idea being that the only thing that justifies a war is what the bottom line if you are victorious. And we found this very disturbing because we were all brought up to believe, well, if you remember the Hasmonean War, its ultimate message in Jewish history was what? That when the righteous go to war against the evil, then the few can defeat the many. There is a prayer that was recited by Jews on Hanukkah that stresses precisely that element, right? That if you are fighting for right and for justice and for what have you, right, then you can be victorious. But remember, it's more than that. We were all, I assume, that most of us were brought up in a Western mentality that said you must fight against the bully, you must oppose the bully, even if the odds are against you, because if no one ever opposes the bully, then right will never ultimately assert itself. And of course, if we were to take this to its logical conclusion, we'd have to go throughout so many other episodes of Jewish history, of world history. I mean, you could argue not just about the Hanukkah episode. You could say, well, were the people who rose up in the Warsaw Ghetto, were they justified? They obviously had no chance of victory. Is that a heroic affair? In other words, what is the bottom line? How do you judge the bottom line? Do you judge the bottom line by who won the battle? Or maybe by making a moral stand? If Bar Kokhba believed he was making a moral stand, that, of course, is a question. The sources tell us that the rebellion was brought about, there are different sources, some say because there was a prohibition against circumcision. Others claim that the Roman Emperor Hadrian was about to build a pagan temple on the Temple Mount. And this is very interesting. I mean, today, if you tamper with the Temple Mount, it's assumed that people will be offended and the whole world, right, will rise up in terrible anguish against that. And why not assume that that was the mentality of the ancient world as well, where if you're tampering with a holy site, expect things like this to happen, right? In fact, if we were to tell Bar Kokhba, how did you go to war against this military machine known as Rome, he would have said, why am I really different from Judah Maccabee? He would have said, I am following in the footsteps of a certain ideology and a certain mentality. Now, you can argue, right, his particular motivation. We can argue that all day. Not only that, you can accept the political premise of Harkavi vis-a-vis the 20th century when he wrote the book. In other words, what I'm saying has absolutely no message regarding the agenda that Harkavi brought to the book. He may be right, he may be wrong. I, as I said, I live in the first century and not in the 20th century, or 21st, I'm told. Now, in other words, that's not the issue here. The issue is, do we point accusing fingers for people who 1900 years ago did not act like us, right? But of course, that's what happens when you begin playing this analogy game. Since you created this past in your own image, that's how you can point accusing fingers. And Harkavi and I actually became a sort of a traveling roadshow. I must tell you, we debated this a number of times. In fact, there was one debate in the Israel Academy of Sciences in the Van Leer building in Jerusalem where the hall was packed. In fact, it was so packed that they had to pipe it into side rooms. And we're on the stage arguing this out, and I was looking in the audience. What fascinated me wasn't Harkavi or myself, it was the audience. You looked into the audience's eyes, and you saw how personally they were taking this argument. Here we were debating events of 1900 years ago, right? And people were almost coming to blows in the audience. I can tell you that this is the way Israelis used to take their history 10, 20 years ago when they still knew some history, right? I can tell you this. I participated once in a TV program on the war against the Romans of the year 70. And I was asked we were role-playing, right? And I was asked to be an extreme zealot, right? To act out the role. In fact, next to me, there was a moderate zealot. And most of you may never have heard of his name. His name was Dr. Israel Eldad. Dr. Israel Eldad was the ideologue of the Lehi movement, which is otherwise known as the Stern Gang, right? And he was the moderate one compared to me. But what was fascinating was the next day while I was walking the street, I had people come over to me, either cursing me or you know, saying, you told off those communists well, right, the way they deserve it, so on. One fellow refused to fill my gas tank, you know, right? In other words, the assumption automatically was, right, that you were representing what you identified with. I took it as a great compliment to my acting. In fact, there was one journalist in one of the newspapers who wrote a whole page on that program and said that the program was frightening, right? Dealt with the destruction of the Second Temple, but everybody heard in it, right? The destruction of the Third Temple, meaning of our state. And his bottom line, it was a frightening program. The most frightening thing were Gaffney's eyes, right? And I, you know, he looked into my eyes and he saw the zeal of this ultra zealot willing to crash, willing to bring the whole state crashing down. But my point is that I find this bottom line use of history to be not just counter-Jewish mentality. I find it almost unethical in a sense. And I remember when we were debating once, as I was giving these examples, he got a little upset with me. And he invented, I'd never heard this word in Hebrew before, but I think most of you will understand it. He suddenly called me something in Hebrew called factualist. And I never heard that word before. What he meant to say is, you're throwing facts at me, right? You're not addressing the pain of a parent who is going to lose a son in battle. And of course, he was going for the jugular here, and he was going for the emotions, and that's how you win over audiences, by doing that. And I said, you know, even that is not fair to Jewish history. Let's take another example where Jews had to ask very difficult questions regarding their survival, their immediate survival. You go to the early Middle Ages, to the Crusades, and you find Christian armies going from Western Europe to conquer the Holy Land, but they're going through communities in Germany, Speyer and Worms, and they surround the local Jewish community, and the Jewish community is actually placed in some sort of a siege, in a tower or what have you. And there will be Jews who are going to commit suicide, but not just commit suicide. They believe that for their children to wind up, as it were, in the hands of these Christian crusaders would be the most horrible fate that they could suffer, and so they are going to kill them as well before taking their own life. You need not identify with that. But here, too, I could say, what about the pain of a Jewish father? And yet that Jewish father thought that by doing what he's going to do to that son, he's doing the most benevolent thing he could do, right? He's preventing him from growing up outside, as it were, outside of the Jewish fold. That's also part of Jewish history. The pain of a Jewish parent has to be understood within the larger context sometimes. And you have to understand something. I'm not promoting death as an ideal. The same Bar Kokhba war that Harkavi wrote about also gave birth or formalized one of the major, I would say, notions of Jewish religion, the idea that ultimately was embraced at the same time, actually, by Christianity, the idea of martyrdom. Ultimately, we'll find it in Islam, as we all know. The idea being that although life is clearly the highest and the most sacred aspect of existence. And according to Jewish tradition, to maintain a person alive, you transgress all of the laws of the Torah to keep a person alive. And I can tell you, I mean, just to give you an example, every time my wife would be pregnant, I'm a traditional Jew, I do not ride a car on the Sabbath. But whenever she was pregnant, I always kind of had this urge that she go into labor on Saturday. I wanted to drive her to the hospital on Saturday through the streets of Jerusalem, possibly even blowing my horn to get a sense of what I was missing all these years and so on. But of course, God would not let me have that that pleasure, as it were, to partake of that hidden fruit, or forbidden fruit, as it were. But you have this element then of maintaining life opposite the element of martyrdom, which became a hallowed Jewish tradition. This idea that in certain unique cases, one foregoes one's private existence for a higher ideal. And this, of course, was lost on Harkavi because the bottom line mentality or the bottom line syndrome refuses to recognize that. right? That sense of a willingness, right, to sacrifice even one's life. And so this is the danger, I fear, of misusing, as it were, ancient history for modern purposes. Now, I have to be honest. Historians always did this. They always played fast and loose with history. I'll give you an example. About to end here. Even the fellow to whom I owe my career, the fellow named Josephus Flavius, who was an ancient Jewish historian. And you know, when I was growing up in Israel in high school, you could not get a high school diploma if you didn't do two things. If you didn't crawl up Masada, right? There was no cable car at the time, right? That was part of the rite of passage. And we also had to put Josephus on trial. Every high school did this. Was he a traitor or was he a realistic politician? Because you know he began the war against the Romans as a Jewish general in the Galilee. And then he goes over to the other side and he becomes a historian. He writes the history of the war, to which I always replied that I don't really care if he was a traitor or not, but if somebody had to be treacherous, thank God it was somebody who had more than a 400-word vocabulary, right, and could actually write what he saw. Whether we believe him or not is already another issue. But the man was a brilliant historian. And he noticed the problem that I've been presenting today. He noticed it in a very interesting way. In his book on the Jewish War Against the Romans, he attacks the zealots of his day for embarking on a foolish war, a war for which they have no chance at victory. He makes speeches. He places other speeches in other people's mouths, makes, as I say, his own speech, saying, how can you defeat the Romans? They outnumber you. They have weapons. They know they have military experience. There's no way you are going to defeat these weapons. What are you? You are a few hundred farmers. The same Josephus wrote another history book on the Jewish antiquities. And in the Jewish antiquities, he also wrote a history or a description of the Maccabean Wars. And in writing on the Maccabean Wars, he is quoting the first book of Maccabees, which was his only source. In that book of Maccabees, Judah Maccabee himself makes speeches. You know that in ancient historiography, everybody makes speeches. This is the way you express ideas. These were speeches that Thucydides told us, right? Not necessarily were made, but should have been made in that reality, right? In any case, Judah Maccabees makes speeches, and Josephus is slavishly copying the first book of Maccabees. And what does Judah say in his speeches? If you read them, he says something very interesting. His soldiers are scared out of their minds. They're going to fight against the Syrian Empire. And he says, have no fear. It is in God's power that the few defeat the many. Now, you realize Josephus has a problem here. The Maccabees are his heroes. In fact, they are even his ancestors. But if he quotes that speech, he will be undermining the very same speeches that he makes later on vis-a-vis the zealots. What is he going to do? So you have a little revisionism here. He slightly amends the speech that Judah made. So what does he have Judah saying? Have no fear. It's in God's power that the few defeat the many if the few are righteous. And he solved everything, right? So the ancient Maccabees, they were righteous, hence they defeated the evil Greeks. But the zealots, they're brigands and say they don't deserve victory, they're going to lose. And you see, this is playing a little fast and loose with history. But historians are allowed to do this, right? I mean, I've told my students this many, many times. And this, if you remember nothing else from this lecture, remember this next line. And that is, I mean, you see, I'm a traditional Jew, right? And I believe, of course, in God's power. And yet I've researched and found that there's something that even God cannot do. No, what is that? God cannot change history. Only historians can do that, right? Now, and they do constantly, right? And so Josephus, no, but why do I like what Josephus did? Because although he changed his source, he did it within the context of Jewish ethos. In other words, he knew that that type of change made sense within the Jewish mentality that says that God helps the righteous, and so thereby he wanted to distinguish between one war and another war. So he's playing within the rules, as it were, even though he's changing his source. What offends me is when we do this in modern times, not always realizing that by changing history, by representing history or misrepresenting history, as it were, we sometimes undermine the educational value and the importance of these historical events. And this I say as an educator in Israel, not so much as a professor, but I think the two are linked. I consider what I do at the university and elsewhere as being part of a calling, not just as a career and a living. I mean, I'll give you an example. We talked about Masada today. Now, Masada was the great symbol of bravery for many years. Today, less. Today, by the way, we swear soldiers in elsewhere and not in Masada. That tells you something about the last two decades in Israel mentality. Things are changing in the Jewish mind. But at the time, it was very interesting. Why did the people at Masada kill themselves? Now, Josephus tells us something very interesting. It was because of a very unique religious mentality that they developed, an idea that if you succumb to Roman rule, if you recognize the sovereign, the Roman emperor, as being emperor, that is tantamount to idolatry. You have to realize why, because the Roman emperors, either upon their death, such as Vespasian, were declared, if the Romans loved them, they proclaimed them gods, right? And this whole issue of emperor worship became very important. And every Jew knew this. If you went to market, you had a coin and it had Vespasian on the coin, and it said Divus Vespasianus, right? Or Divus Augustus, right? In other words, it would say that you knew. In fact, Jews, we know this, by the way, from archaeology, they would very often take out their penknife and rub off the picture of the emperor, thereby, as it were, destroying an idol. You know, if a little gold or silver came off, you could pocket that. That would be an inducement to piety. But we have these faceless coins, as it were, in the past. But what is the point? These people believed that they cannot succumb to the Roman general, because by succumbing to the Roman general, they would be recognizing some other deity, and so they must, right, give up their lives. In other words, Masada, for whatever happened there, the underlying impetus for the supposed suicide or real suicide was a religious one. Now, what happens is very interesting. There are two sectors in the state of Israel. There is a religious sector and there is a secular sector. Which of the two sectors embraced Masada as the sign of bravery? It was the secular one. Well, the religious had their own heroes, Akiva and then the 10 martyrs and what have you. So they had a very strange situation where an event that had an underlying religious, or you could say fanatic religious, impetus, was embraced by a secular community. And that caused tremendous misunderstanding. And I, as I tell you, soldiers and people would come up to Masada and they never really got the message, right? What are we being told? So you could say Masada should never fall. But that's a very sophisticated message. What do you mean Masada should never fall? We were told that people committed suicide here for a very particular reason. And that's what, of course, is so striking. But why commit suicide? Isn't that crazy? And so on and so forth. We do this on all sorts of levels, where we play fast and loose with history. I mean, even some of you and me, when we were brought up as children and we sang songs on Hanukkah, right? And one of the songs, I don't know if I should sing for you now. I mean, right? Mi Yemalel, huh? Right. Give Urot Yisrael. Right. That's very nice. Who can tell the heroics of Israel? Who can count them? There's only one problem with that nice little ditty. It's based on scripture. But the scripture is, Mi Yimalel Gvurot Hashem. Who can say the glories of God? And what you have is that the Zionist movement, of which I am a proud member, right, changed the text because it did not quite fit in. And in fact, this was a whole different ethos. Now, I have an aversion to that. I don't like playing with the past to have it fit into your particular mentality. And I could bring, of course, so many other examples. My point is, there's no such thing as half-truths. Half-truths are lies. And what scares me is that we've brought up a generation in Israel, unfortunately, of kids who were severed from the completeness of a culture, again, and this has nothing to do with the religious secular schism, but what I'm talking about here is simply knowing the past, but we were taught a past that was fashioned to fit into a particular ideology, and that past was, as I say, shaped and reshaped, and this is something that we should try to avoid at all costs. I think that the survival, not only of the Jewish state, right? I think of the Jewish people is based, among other things, on a knowledge of its heritage and a knowledge of, which is, I think, what we're all doing here this evening, or many of us are doing here this evening, a knowledge of the past, a knowledge of the heritage, not identifying with everything that happened in the past. You don't have to be, you know, feel comfortable with everything, but at least try to achieve an accurate and a fair knowledge. Now, you had the good fortune. See, it's very, most historians, of course, are politically motivated. You had the good fortune this evening of hearing one of the last few objective historians on the planet, right? And clearly, the message, I think, should be quite obvious. If there are questions, I would be very, very happy to take them.